Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome Eric Jantz. He is a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we are facing a whole new world here in New Mexico in many ways. We have a new governor coming in. We have an economic deficit, a budget deficit of proportions that we haven't seen in a while. We have some real concerns about economic development, public health, and the environment, all of which are related to one another. Let's start talking about the relationship between jobs and environmental protection. We have heard since I was a little kid that there are always conflicts between jobs and economic development on the one hand and protecting the environment on the other. What's your take on that?
Well, my take is, and it's really not my take, it's the take of economists across the country who are, not bound to the conventional notions of what economies should look like, is that economics and environment are complementary. And in fact, clean environments are critical to sustainable long-term economic development.
Sustainable long-term is the operative concept there, because
right.
You can rape and pillage a piece of land, let's say, get a lot of money out of it, but that's short-term.
Right, that's short-term, and oftentimes the amount of money you get out of it is pooled in a very small number of hands. So it doesn't really benefit the larger society and the communities at large. Now, there have been a number of studies, economic studies, about sort of the changing demographics in the West, the Western U.S., as well as what kind of economic development is really most beneficial for counties in the West. And the one I'm thinking most about is by a nonprofit economic think tank called Headwaters Economics, based in Montana. They generated a study in 2008 that compared the economic development trends in communities that rely almost exclusively or predominantly on natural resource extraction versus those that don't, that have more diversified economies. And they found that over the long term, the economic growth in communities that didn't rely exclusively on resource extraction tended to grow more steadily and better over time.
What were some of the elements of their economic diversity in terms of the bases of their economy? I'm thinking of a state like New Mexico, which certainly has some mineral resources under the ground.
Certainly. And they actually took a look at some of the counties in southern New Mexico, Lee County, Eddy County, Otero County, along with counties throughout the West that did rely on these extractive industries. And it turns out that those with the more diversified economies, the ones that rely on investment income, retirees, tourism, intellectual and service industries, or knowledge-based and service industries, those are the ones that tended to fare better over time.
All of those examples you mentioned are examples of industries that don't actually really produce anything.
Well, I mean, that's one way of thinking about it, I suppose. However, there's another study that came out that was produced by the REP. It's the Renewable Energy Policy Project. And this study took a look at the jobs created by various energy-related industries. And it found that on a per megawatt basis, renewables, photovoltaic production, and wind production over the entire cycle of the process from manufacturing for example, the blades and the wind turbines, to constructing the wind farms, to maintaining the wind farms, and generating electricity, that those kind of jobs actually had a much better per megawatt employment benefit than traditional coal mine and coal-fired power plant.
Interesting.
So while a lot of these economies or bases of economies may not be actually manufacturing or producing a tangible object, there are those sort of industries that actually do produce these things, tangible things, physical products, that are actually more beneficial in terms of jobs than your traditional resource extraction. So, it takes both, I think. And that's, I think, the point of the Headwater study, is that a diversified economy is a much stronger economy. And, I think that's sort of conventional wisdom in terms of survival of the fittest in evolution, right, is that, a more diversified population tends to do a lot better than a very specialized one, which tends to die out.
One of the reasons that we're having this conversation about extractive industries is related to questions of the new Republican gubernatorial administration under Susana Martinez, which is very oil and gas heavy, at least that's the way it looks so far with the transition team, and with oil and gas people being in charge of environmental protection, there are some real worries that are being raised.
Absolutely. I think you don't really have to look very far to follow the money about where Susana Martinez's interests are going to lie. Her largest contributors to her campaign were the oil and gas industry and the construction industry. So, I think she's going to owe some favors, and that's beginning to be made clear in her transition team that's picking the secretaries of the environment and the energy, minerals, and natural resources division. It's very heavy with the oil and gas executives. And while industry interests are part of the interests in the fabric of our society and our state, I don't think that the industries that are being regulated should necessarily be the people who are doing the regulating as well. And that seems to be where this is going to go.
The proverbial fox guarding the hen house.
Precisely.
So one of the pieces of Martinez's platform was to try to get rid of the pit rule. What is the pit rule?
Well, the pit rule is a regulation that regulates the disposal of waste from oil and gas operations. When oil and gas operations drill for the resource, either oil or natural gas or coal bed methane, as a byproduct, there are a number of really very nasty chemicals that get produced, and many of them are carcinogens. A lot of them lead to acute health problems, and some are even endocrine disruptors. That is, they're chemicals that disrupt how and when hormones fire in the body during the development stages, both embryonic and in the early stages of human development.
Which means you have young people growing up with potentially real problems in the development of their sexual organs, in other parts of their endocrine system.
Yeah, it can lead to all kinds of problems, reproductive problems down the line, cognitive problems. It's a real nasty brew of chemicals that are the byproduct of natural gas, coal bed methane, and oil production.
So the pit rule was designed to prevent those from going into our bodies?
Well, into the groundwater and subsequently into our bodies. Prior to the pit rule, essentially oil and gas companies could dump their waste in an unlined hole in the ground. And as you might imagine, these things kind of leach into the ground and into groundwater eventually. And during the pit rule proceeding in 2007, the Oil and Gas Conservation Division, Oil Conservation Division, presented evidence of at least 400 instances where groundwater had been contaminated by the contents of a pit, an oil and gas pit. So, what this does is essentially it prohibits burying waste unless it meets certain criteria. It requires that burial pits and temporary pits be lined.
Lined with a plastic.
With like a polyurethane liner kind of thing. It's called a geomembranous liner. And that in certain circumstances, closed-loop systems have to be used. That is, you don't put anything in a pit. They go into tanks, and the wastewater is recycled, and essentially all the waste is hauled off, or hauling off waste to a regulated facility. So essentially, the goal was to keep these little toxic pockets of pollution from being spread everywhere in the state and having them in one centralized facility or two centralized facility where they could be monitored rather than having these little Superfund sites all over the state buried underground.
So the cost of either lining pits with a polyurethane liner, using closed-loop systems, recycling wastewater, hauling waste away. Mm-hmm. How much of a cost does that add to the production of oil and gas?
Well, there was a lot of evidence in the PIT rule submitted by both industry and the New Mexico Environmental Law Center on behalf of its clients, the Oil and Gas Accountability Project. And worst-case scenario, the cost of the new PIT rule amounts to 3 to 5% of the return on investment. And we're talking about return on investments of 25 to 29% for some of these companies.
Okay.
So, you know, you're talking about huge profits, tremendous profit
margins.
They've
got a big margin to work with.
They have a substantial margin to work with. And in fact, we actually produced a witness, a woman who is an oil and gas accountant from Colorado, who works on behalf of oil and gas lease owners, who get obviously a cut, a percentage royalty from oil and gas operations on their leases from their minerals. And her testimony was, based on her experience in Colorado, that sometimes that these things can actually save oil and gas companies money.
Because, how does that work?
Well, because for a closed-loop system, which was what she addressed, the waste in a lot of cases is being recycled and reused over and over and over again. And so they don't have to worry about the costs of dealing with that waste during the process of extracting the mineral. And you know, I think that another thing that some of the oil and gas producers aren't looking at is the long-term costs, one, to taxpayers to clean up groundwater eventually, and two, their own liability. Because if a particular instance of contamination ever gets traced to a particular oil company, you know, they're going to be on the hook for whatever damages to groundwater, damages to human health. So, I mean, it seems like it'd be a good practice for them to engage in just from their own financial interests in the long term.
I think also when you look at cost, if the oil companies spend 0 to 5% of their profits, or -2 to 5% of their profits, lining pits and taking care that toxins, really nasty toxins, don't go into the groundwater of the people around them, they are preserving their own workforce.
Yeah, and I think that's true too. I mean, I think that really from a public health standpoint, everybody benefits here. Not only the public at large, the property owners who are forced to host these oil and gas operations, but also the oil and gas workers themselves.
So why are they against it? Why are they against the PIT rule?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to say for sure. My speculation is that, you know, oil and gas, because it's such a big contributor to New Mexico's economy and has been for many years, they're used to calling shots, and they're used to being able to dictate in a lot of ways how they do business to property owners, the public, and the administrative agencies.
So it's as, how shall I say this, as simple and sort of psychologically crude as, you can't tell me what to do.
Well, that may be. That may be. Again, this is just sort of speculation on my part, but, you know, I think it may be that they really just don't want to be told what to do. Another sort of common sort of psychological thing that goes on with industries, any regulated industry, is that once they think that the public has a foot in the door in terms of asserting power, they think it's going to be a slippery slope, that eventually it's going to get to the point where they're so regulated in their minds that they can't do business. So I think that they may think that this is just the beginning.
Some people might call that democracy.
Some people might.
We're talking to Eric Jantz, who is a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. So how strong is the PIT rule as it currently stands? Is it being implemented?
It is currently the law right now, yes, and it is being implemented.
So they've lined their pits and they're doing this stuff?
They have to line their pits now. They have to. The waste in the pits has to meet New Mexico groundwater quality standards. And it's all these things that the PIT rule requires is having to be done now. And, you know, so far we haven't had any indication that it's bad for business. In fact, 8 months after the PIT rule was passed, Governor Richardson met with oil and gas executives and ordered that certain parts of it be rolled back. And there was a public hearing on that rollback. And interestingly enough, nobody presented any evidence, neither industry nor the New Mexico Oil Conservation Division, about the economic impact on oil and gas producers.
So, meaning presumably they didn't have any negative impact to report.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether they didn't have any, whether they just didn't present any evidence because they figured they were going to get this rule anyway. I honestly don't know. But I do know that they didn't present that evidence, and so we really have nothing to work on except for these sort of unsubstantiated assertions by oil and gas industry.
You said when we started off talking about this that when the Pitt rule was being considered, there were examples of 400 contamination sites in the state of New Mexico. If in some way or other the Pitt rule were to be removed or rolled back or repealed or whatever, what would that mean, in your view, for the state's water supply in the future?
Well, I think it can do nothing but jeopardize the state's water supply. And I read a story in the New Mexican recently that indicated that since the Pitt rule has passed, there have been no instances of groundwater contamination. It may be too early to tell at this point, but I think that, you know, is at least strongly indicative that this thing is working. And, you know, at the very least, the preliminary results are really encouraging. So I think that if the Pitt rule is eliminated or substantially changed to weaken it, I just don't see that it's going to be anything but detrimental for groundwater supplies in New Mexico. And that's really important in a state like New Mexico that's dry and one where 90% of the people rely on groundwater for drinking water supplies.
Not to mention agricultural water, which also absorbs this and eventually gets into the food supply.
Absolutely.
If groundwater is contaminated, how hard or easy is it to clean it up?
It's incredibly hard and incredibly expensive to clean it up. So if, for example, a oil and gas company, a small operator, say, isn't able to bear the full costs or goes bankrupt or just walks away, then the taxpayers are on the hook for that cleanup. And as I said, it can be incredibly expensive.
This is another example of something that we've seen in the United States, and I don't think it's been talked about, but I don't think it's been talked about enough, which is private companies make the profits, the public, the taxpayers, bear the losses.
Right. I mean, this is it's classic privatizing profits, socializing risk.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
One would think that the employees of oil and gas companies would want both jobs and safe drinking water. That doesn't seem too tall an order, as we've been discussing. What are they saying?
I've heard from a number of different folks who, you know, work in the oil and gas fields that they do want both. I mean, they do want both. I think that those folks are in a really difficult position because, you know, I think none of us want to take food out of people's mouths, and none of us want anybody to go without health insurance, especially in, you know, sort of the economic environment that we're in right now. And, you know, I think a lot of these oil and gas field workers they're a couple of things going on. One, they've sort of have some sort of denial, and they bought into the management position of, yeah, these regulations are gonna make us lose our jobs, cause us to lose our jobs, and it's the environmentalists versus the working folks. But then there are others who really do appreciate the dangers and who have, you know, seen the problems and are cognizant of them, but they can't speak out because they'll lose their jobs. I mean, I can't imagine any oil and gas field worker who's going to go public with, you know, complaints against their company because of the risk of losing that job.
What would have to happen for the Pitt rule to be overturned? Would the legislature have to do it? Can the governor do it? How does it work?
Well, right now, the Pitt rule and the Pitt rule rollback are both being appealed in state district court. And that hearing is on Friday the 10th at 2 o'clock, 1st Judicial District here in Santa Fe. It's a public hearing.
So that means that everybody who's listening today can show up?
Certainly if they so desire. And the district court judge will rule on both those appeals, then there'll be the opportunity to go to the appeals court and eventually the New Mexico Supreme Court.
Does the public have the opportunity to comment or just to witness?
Just to witness at this point, yeah. So, I mean, my hope would be that the administration and the legislature would let the judiciary do its job and let this thing work its way through the court system. You know, barring that, I mean, there are a couple of things that could happen. The legislature could amend the Oil and Gas Act to prohibit the Oil Conservation Division from being able to protect environment. The new administration could go through a rulemaking, another rulemaking, to change, amend, weaken, or do away with entirely the pit rule.
And would the public have anything to say about that or any participation in the rulemaking?
Yeah, I mean, ostensibly it would be a public rulemaking. So, yeah, I mean, my hope would be that there would be extensive public hearings on these things.
We're talking to Eric Jantz. He's a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. So what do you expect to happen to the departments and agencies in state government that are currently in charge of environmental protection?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. Susana Martinez didn't really say very much during her campaign about environmental issues, other than to say, you know, the standard line of wanting to repeal so-called job-killing regulations. I think sort of the feeling within impacted communities and environmental groups and environmental justice groups is that they're going to be largely industry appointees or industry affiliated appointees in these positions. So it's going to be people from industry regulating industry.
Let's talk for a moment about uranium mining, because that's another issue that the New Mexico Environmental Law Center follows. To what extent is uranium being mined in New Mexico today? To what extent has it been mined in the past?
Well, right now there's no uranium mining in New Mexico. And I think that a lot of the people, I know a lot of the people in the uranium impacted communities would like to keep it that way. Largely because of the impacts from historic uranium mining.
What kind of impacts?
Well, there are substantial impacts. New Mexico was a hub of uranium mining from the 1950s through the mid-1980s, when the uranium market crashed. And as a result, there are millions, if not billions, of gallons of groundwater that have been contaminated, thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of tons of soil that have been contaminated with radiation and other heavy metals, and significant public health results because of that, public health impacts. There have been some recent studies done by community-based organizations that have demonstrated that there's a pretty dramatic correlation or association between living near an abandoned uranium mine and certain diseases, kidney diseases and autoimmune diseases. There's some suggestion that diabetes may even be implicated.
These kinds of studies that have been undertaken to examine the effects of uranium mining on people living in those areas, my understanding is that there haven't really been sufficient studies in this area. Particularly in New Mexico.
There haven't been. And it's not just New Mexico. It's all over the uranium country, the Utah, Arizona, Colorado, Wyoming. I mean, there haven't really been a lot of studies about the effects of uranium wastes, uranium mining and milling waste, on public health. And I think to a certain extent that's due to bureaucratic inertia. I think it's due to a large extent willful ignorance on the part of regulators and certainly industry. Because I think that once more studies are done, it's going to become increasingly clear that these mine wastes and mill wastes are incredibly dangerous from a public health perspective.
The people who are in those mining communities in New Mexico, are they primarily Native people?
To a large extent, they are Native people. It's not exclusively. I mean, there are a number of Anglo communities that have been impacted, a number of Chicano, Latino communities that have been impacted as well. So, I mean, these things don't really have any sort of particular bias in terms of who's impacted, other than I don't think there are very many wealthy communities that have been impacted.
Because it does really raise a question of what public health studies get done and what don't, and why.
Right. And I think that it's important to note that most of the impacted communities are low-income communities and or rural communities, and oftentimes minority communities. And so these are communities that generally haven't had much political power and currently don't have a whole lot of political power. I mean, there are plenty of uranium deposits in Santa Fe County, up around the Pewaukee area, but you know, I think that we're never going to see any kind of mining in the area. Just because of the demographics of this area. I mean, it's all going to happen in the poorer and more minority communities in Cibola and McKinley County.
So where should New Mexico go in terms of when we're talking about uranium mining as a potential industry? We could talk about that in a moment, too. But in terms of dealing with questions about public health around uranium mining, not to mention oil and gas
right.
extraction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the issue of uranium mining is particularly poignant because the information we do have suggests that it's an incredibly dangerous industry from a public health standpoint. So, I mean, I think that what communities want and what they certainly deserve in New Mexico is before there's any new uranium mining, and I should say that there's a tremendous amount of pressure to begin new uranium mining, especially
from whom?
Well, there are actually a number of different companies who have proposals online. There's a Texas company, Hydro Resources Incorporated, that wants to mine in a number of sites in Crown Point and Church Rock. On the Navajo Reservation, or near the Navajo Reservation. And then there's a plan for a conventional mine, the Roca Honda mine, that's been proposed by Roca Honda Resources, which is a joint venture between a Canadian mining company, Strathmore, and a Japanese multinational, Sumitomo. And then there's a talk of restarting the Mount Taylor mine near Grants as well. And that's Rio Grande Resources, which is a local shell company.
Are there any laws governing the contamination of groundwater? So let's say you start mining and you contaminate the groundwater. Is that just legal?
No, it's certainly not legal. But once the groundwater is contaminated, it's really tough to do anything about it. You know, you get fined $1,000 a day or something like that for every day that there's a problem. And then once the company starts to try to remediate, there usually aren't any fines. So, and especially in a industry-controlled administration like the one we expect from Susana Martinez, it's hard to conceive that there'll even be very many fines that are going to be issued. Although, it's an interesting sort of position that Susana Martinez is in as a district attorney. You know, she was there to be tough on crime, right? And I honestly do hope that she's tough on environmental crimes as well and white collar crimes. But back to the next steps on public health, I think that the communities want and deserve, especially in light of pressure to start new uranium mining. Before there's any new uranium mining, I think that there needs to be some assessment of the public health impacts from past uranium mining, what sort of impact it's had on these communities from a public health standpoint, as well as an environmental standpoint, and have some comprehensive environmental baseline surveys What does groundwater in the area look like now? What does surface water in the area look like now? What is the extent of contamination of soils? Things like that. We really have no very good idea about any of those things.
Who is equipped to do those studies? Universities? Government agencies?
All of the above. I certainly wouldn't trust the uranium industry to do those surveys, but I think it's, well worth expending public dollars to at least have some idea of what's going on in these communities before we start to jeopardize them any further.
I think all of this needs to be contextualized also within a larger energy strategy in the state of New Mexico. I mean, we're talking about uranium for potential nuclear plants, which people are talking about, and there's a lot of controversy about whether nuclear energy should or can be considered green. The only thing we know for sure is that it's extremely expensive, and the cost of nuclear power plants would have to be borne by taxpayers. But there are other energy strategies for the state of New Mexico besides nuclear energy far off in the future and oil and gas now, or in addition to oil and gas now, namely renewable energies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, New Mexico has just tremendous resources in terms of solar and wind potential. I think that one strategy that is being looked at and actually implemented to some degree in uranium-impacted communities, at least in New Mexico, is brownfield redevelopment for renewable energy purposes, taking these contaminated uranium mine or mill sites, cleaning them up to the point where they're not going to be a public health hazard, and putting wind farms or concentrated solar projects on them. And I think
interesting, because if you clean them up enough, nobody wants to actually live there, but you could put wind and solar.
You could put wind farms and solar concentrated solar projects on these sites. And so I think that really, in my mind, the future of New Mexico's economy in a large part, because let's face it, the industry, the uranium and oil and gas are finite resources. They're gonna go eventually. They're gonna be depleted eventually. But the wind is gonna blow forever, as the sun is gonna shine forever.
Or forever, certainly in human scale.
On human scale, and when the sun ceases to shine, there are gonna be a lot bigger problems than.
We won't be here.
Yeah, whether or not the lights in your house go on.
Another piece that I think is important to talk about and for people to understand who are thinking about the future of energy in New Mexico and in the United States is that even when you do solar energy, even when you do wind energy, there is a greenhouse gas impact because you've got to build these things and you've got to move stuff around on roads and whatnot, and there are greenhouse gas impacts of doing oil and gas, of doing uranium, of doing nuclear, of doing wind and solar.
Right.
How do they compare?
Well, there have been a number of studies that have done that compare renewables specifically to nuclear, because nuclear is the energy source that's touted as being carbon-free, which is grossly inaccurate. It's lower carbon than coal or oil and gas. Certainly, but it's not carbon free. Now, the Oko Institute in Germany did a study several years ago that compared the life cycle carbon emissions that is from the beginning of the fuel source to the disposal of the fuel source for nuclear as compared to wind and solar, and they found that nuclear generated about 35 grams of carbon per kilowatt hour. Wind was in the range of 10 to 12, and solar generated between 20 and 25 grams per kilowatt hour. So on a per kilowatt hour basis, nuclear doesn't really come close to either solar or wind. And, you know, that's sort of a mid-range for, you know, the studies that I've seen on greenhouse gas emissions from nuclear versus renewables.
You talked a moment ago about places where uranium mining has historically happened, Cibola County. Cibola County is also one of the counties that was studied in the study that you were talking about earlier, of counties that do have a diverse economic base.
Yes. Actually, Cibola County was the subject of a study that the Law Center commissioned from the chair emeritus of the University of Montana Economics Department, a guy named Thomas Power. And this guy's specialty is resource economics. And he evaluated data from the 1950s to the 1990s, economic data from Cibola County, which used to be Valencia County as well, and found that actually the Cibola County has outperformed many similarly situated and energy extractive counties because its economy is diversifying. So I think that it weathered the boom or weathered the uranium bust fairly well because it started to diversify its economy. I heard an interview with the Cibola County manager on the radio the other week, and it sounds to me like unfortunately the pendulum may be swinging back toward a more resource extractive intensive economy for that county, at least from that decision maker's perspective.
What resources do communities in New Mexico have for making decisions about how they want to do their economies?
Well, I mean, I think that the democratic processes that are, inherent in our government, going to community, to county commission meetings, running people for county commission, city councils, state legislatures, lobbying your state legislators, putting pressure on elected officials to do the things that that communities want to have done, I think is a good place to start. I think that communities often feel, exasperated. People in communities often feel exasperated and disenfranchised and oftentimes powerless because they see elected officials hobnobbing with industry representatives, and the next thing you know, those industries get great big gifts from the legislature.
Well, what if a community said in somewhere in the middle of New Mexico, we've got a lot of land around here and we want to do wind, but we don't have the capital to do wind? In other words, what can counties or municipalities do to direct their economy in a way that is compatible with A, economics, and B, public health?
Well, I mean, I think that has to be a conscious policy decision by those county governments and small rural city governments. And I think, it's important for the residents of those counties and communities to go out and make sure that their legislators know that this is the direction they want their economies to take. And I think that, to a certain extent, some counties or communities, can act outside the government context. There have been a number of renewable energy cooperatives that I've read about in Massachusetts and New York State that have been fairly successful, and those could potentially serve as a model for real grassroots community run economic endeavors in New Mexico.
And energy generation, energy selling.
Energy generation, energy export. Yeah, exactly.
Very interesting. So we have been talking to and will continue to be talking to people in the environmental community who are concerned about the next 4 years in this government in terms of protecting public health, in terms of protecting the environment, and in terms of protecting and and fostering jobs in new energy sectors. How does it look right now? What should the public be thinking about, and what can the public do to act in its own best interest in the coming months, in the coming years?
Well, I think that it has to start with being engaged. I don't think there's any way around that. I think that people need to be engaged to the extent they can. I understand that, you know, most people have jobs that don't involve this sort of advocacy.
Being a staff attorney on the New Mexico Environmental
Law Center. Right. I consider myself incredibly fortunate to be able to do this, you know, for a living. This is my job. It's a great job. But, you know, not everybody can do that. And I can absolutely appreciate that, you know, people have family obligations, work obligations that don't include this sort of advocacy. But I think, you know, even taking a few minutes to make phone calls to the legislature, to a legislator during the legislative session are important. And I think that, you know, to the extent that they can, you know, come out to legislative meetings, actually meet with their legislator in person, actually go to county commission meetings, I think those are important. Because, I mean, there's going to be a lot of issues that are going to come up during this legislative session that I think are going to be important. I mean, one thing that the environmental community is really worried about is rollbacks of the Water Quality Act, and that's the piece of legislation that protects all groundwater in New Mexico and keeps it clean for use for this generation and future generations.
Can I just ask whether there are mental illnesses associated with not wanting to have clean water? I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that that's a tough one to answer because, I mean, nobody can really disagree and nobody publicly disagrees with the proposition that everybody should have clean water. But, I mean, when you get down to it, when you're in these legislative sessions or administrative rulemakings, you know, you have people advocating for positions that are going to result in groundwater contamination. And I don't know how those people reconcile these two sort of which seemed to me completely opposite ideas.
I think also another distinction that's important to make is that sometimes when people say it's about jobs, it's not about jobs, it's about profits. And those two aren't the same thing. When shareholders and executives make profits, they're not necessarily and not often creating new jobs for New Mexicans with the profits they make. They're taken out of state or they're used in state to build very nice houses and buy rings and things like that.
No, I think that's a really important distinction to make. In fact, jobs are often anathema to profits. I mean, jobs is an expense. Companies get by with the minimum amount of workforce and labor force that they can get away with to, you know, maximize their profits. I mean, it's interesting that you talked about exporting profits because in the context of the uranium mining industry, all those companies are foreign companies. These are...
Foreign meaning out of state or out of country?
Both. Mostly out of country, though. Mostly Canadian and Japanese financial interests. Susana Martinez has made a big deal about going after the driver's license for...
Immigrants
who are, you know, allegedly in the country illegally. I hope she takes the same hard line on foreign corporations that have a bad record for environmental crimes and making sure that those companies don't get permits in this state either.
To what extent are environmental organizations here in New Mexico working together, sharing information, mobilizing the public?
I think that there's, in the light of the last election, I think that it was a big jolt to a lot of the environmental groups here. We've had the luxury in the last 8 years of an administration, while not who hasn't necessarily agreed with us on everything, has at least listened to us. And it seems to me that those days may be over. I think that we've taken a lot of steps already to increase the lines of communication between us between groups as well as with groups and their constituencies, including communities who are impacted by polluting industry.
When you have an administration, and Lord knows we've lived through this in your lifetime and mine, many administrations on the national level and also on the state level that are hostile toward environmental concerns, what can people do to gain leverage? Are we helpless victims? How do we not be helpless victims?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the idea of victimhood. I mean, I think that that when communities stand up for themselves, when people stand up for themselves, these sort of interests often back down. That these sort of interests who are solely interested in profit, profit margins, are ultimately will back down. So, I mean, I think it's important that people engage now more than ever. I mean, I think that it's important even when they're friendly, so-called friendly administrations, for people to engage. But it's more important now than ever to make sure that decision makers understand that people won't tolerate their communities being polluted.
And I think it's also important to make clear distinctions. In other words, nobody's saying stop all drilling in the state now. We drive cars and so on. We heat our houses and all of that. It's saying do it in as safe a way as is possible to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think anybody. Well, I know that nobody from the environmental side of things is advocating that society shut down. But we do. I mean, I think that we at the Law Center believe, and a lot of the groups that we work with believe, that there can be a just transition from, you know, this fossil fuel-based economy to a sustainable green energy economy. And then it can be done with a minimum of economic dislocation and still preserve, you know, a high standard of living that we enjoy in the United States. So, I mean, this idea that we want to make sure everybody's living in caves and driving horses and buggies is simply, I mean, it's just silly.
And eating organic carrots.
Eating grass and bark.
Right.
I mean, it's
in
just...
In the dark.
Yeah, it really is... taken the hyperbole to a ridiculous point.
And young people, kids, if you're listening, you get to engage too. You get to work with your teachers and you get to go to the legislature.
Absolutely.
In the new year, there'll be a big legislative session, and adults and people who are retired and people who work at home, everybody gets to engage. I think it's so important to really talk about that too.
Everybody gets to engage. Everybody should engage. You know, if you have questions about how you can engage, you can call us at the Law Center. Our webpage is www.nmelc.org.
That stands for New Mexico Environmental Law Center.
Correct. And, you know, we have... during the legislative session, we have regular updates on Twitter and Facebook about bills that are going through. When the legislature is not in session, we have regular updates and alerts about particular rulemakings that we're engaged in. And, you know, there are a lot of good environmental groups and environmental justice and community groups all throughout New Mexico where you can plug in and get engaged in your communities.
Eric Jantz is a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and our email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.